Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Friday, April 29, 2022. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Myers, myself as Chair, Senator Holland. Senator Hughes is here. She's sitting at the presenter's table right now. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Nate, our moderator today. And as a reminder, if you have your cell phones on board, which I'm guilty of myself, make sure they're muted. All right. So at this time, we're going to bring Senate Bill 140 back before the committee. This is the first hearing on Senate Bill, first hearing on Senate Bill 140 in Senate Judiciary. I've seen it before in Senate Education. That's why it looks so familiar. Senator Hughes, would you care to introduce your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F, and this, I believe, would be take four for you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate your indulgence. As the other members haven't heard it, we're going to try to keep it a little faster than what we did the first round. So we'll begin by laying a foundation. 50 years ago, women's sports changed forever. In 1972, slightly over 300,000 women and girls played college and high school sports in the U.S. As of 2022, the number of female athletes in the U.S. has increased by over 900% to more than 3.5 million women and girls, thanks to the passage of Title IX. In fact, when I was a child or a teenager, I'll date myself here, I loved basketball. I shot hoops in my driveway, but there was no way for me to play at my high school. Only option was to be a cheerleader, and that was not my thing. Fortunately, my daughter had the option due to Title IX and played varsity girls basketball in high school. But this year, as we celebrate Title IX's 50th anniversary, women and girls stand once more at risk of losing an even playing field in sports. An ever-increasing trend of male-bodied athletes in women's sports threatens competition and fairness. Girls and women should not be robbed of the chance to be selected for a team, to win a championship, or to be awarded scholarships due to physical advantages of male-bodied athletes. Title IX promises no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation or be denied the benefits of or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. SB 140 seeks to ensure we don't revert to discriminating against girls and women, as was the case pre-1970s. SB 140 protects an even playing field in women's sports by creating an eligibility requirement that members on a school athletic or sports designated female, women, or girls be biologically female based on the athlete's biological sex at birth. Undeniable evidence and scientific research conclude that the average biological male body is stronger, larger, and faster than the average female body even after testosterone suppression treatment. This is particularly true in high school athletics. For example, many male high school track and field athletes consistently beat the times of the very best female Olympians who've trained intensely for years. As many of you are aware, this topic has come to the forefront of public debate online and in the news. Trans women are dominating in a variety of women's sports, both at the collegiate and high school level nationwide. You may have seen in the news that 16 members of the UPenn swim team authored a joint letter to their school regarding their teammate, Leah Thomas, who is a trans woman. They wrote, "We fully support Leah Thomas in her decision to affirm her gender identity and to transition from a man to a woman. Leah has every right to live her life authentically. However, we also recognize that when it comes to sports competition, that the biology of sex is a separate issue from someone's gender identity. Biologically, Leah holds an unfair advantage over competition in the women's category, as evidenced by her rankings that have bounced from 462nd as a male to number one as a female. Leah's inclusion with unfair biological advantages means that we have lost competitive opportunities. Some of us have lost records." That's the end of the quote from the letter. This is the concern addressed by SB 140. "To those accuse me of being transphobia and full of hatred, your words could not be farther from the truth. I love and value every single person. Trans athletes like Leah Thomas deserve the opportunity to compete and win fairly. However, it must not come at the cost of excluding otherwise qualifying biological females from the only category of sport in which they can hope to succeed. Senate Bill 140 is neutral when it comes to gender identity and does not factor in individuals' choices about their sexuality into their eligibility to play school sports. It offers every athlete an equal opportunity to compete on at least two teams they are eligible for, a co-ed team and a team that aligns with their biological sex at birth. The spirit of SB 140 is rooted in Title IX and seeks to establish protections for women and girls so that they will not be robbed of future opportunities. This legislation has received hundreds of hours of work from national experts and attorneys familiar with Title IX and relevant case law, including binding Ninth Circuit precedent in Clark versus Arizona, in which the court upheld the right for sex-separate athletic teams and prohibited boys from playing on the girls' volleyball team. In the previous committee of referral, roughly 7.5 hours were spent analyzing this bill. Four were public testimony. The remaining 3.5 were a review of constitutional matters in two of the three hearings. Six amendments were adopted to tighten the bill and remove any doubt that SB 140 infringes on constitutional rights. Today, we have two attorneys licensed and barred in Alaska as invited testimony who can speak to the constitutionality of the bill as it pertains to our state constitution. The first is Mario Byrd, who practices in Anchorage, and the second is our very own Attorney General, Treg Taylor. Both are prepared to speak to the legality of this legislation. I remain confident that through the course of our deliberation in this Judiciary Committee, SB 140 will prove to be constitutionally sound. And at this time, we have a few slides, Mr. Chair, to highlight a few of the points as far as the physiological differences and some of the legal considerations.
A brief at ease. All right, Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Daniel, if you care to put yourself on the record, are you going to be presenting the slides?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, my name is Daniel Phelps, staff to Majority Leader Shelley Hughes. Members of the committee, the reasoning for SB 140 is threefold. First, women across the state and across the country have come forward in multitudes asking for their athletic programs to be protected. Second, science and research indicate an indisputable athletic advantage in male bodies as compared to female bodies. And third, our country's laws, particularly Title IX, prohibit discrimination based on sex in education programs, including sports, and our country's courts have consistently recognized and established precedent of physiological differences between men and women, which merit sex-based separation in athletics. To begin, Mr. Chair, we'd like you to consider the input from athletes.
I'll quickly read their quotes. I have won my first ever high school track meet. If it weren't for this male-bodied athlete, it was very disappointing. Those with a male sex advantage should not be able to compete in women's sports. I don't know of a woman athlete who doesn't want trans girls to be treated fairly, but the cost of treating her fairly should not come at the cost of discriminating against a biologically female at birth woman. I didn't feel it was fair for this athlete to be playing and taking away a position from girls who could have started, which to me was so wrong on so many levels. We know who's going to win the race before it even begins. It just seems like all our hard work is going down the drain. I knew that I was the fastest girl here, one of the fastest in the state. Then the gun went off and I lost. When it comes to women's sports, biology matters. When it comes to competitive athletes, sex segregation is the only way to achieve equality for girls and women. And before we touch very briefly touch on the science and go into legal matters, I encourage you to go back and look at who stated those. Those were incredible female athletes, Olympians included.
One moment. Is this on basis? Do we have the slideshow? Okay, you have to find us so we can put it on. Oh,
okay, we will do that.
Mr. Chair, now we'll turn to some of the science and research that's been done on this topic. The British Medicine Journal found that 15 to 31% athletic advantage for trans women pre-therapy. Furthermore, they found 9% faster mean run speeds in trans women after 1 year of testosterone suppression. The Hilton-Lundberg study found a 10 to 50% performance gap depending on the sport, and they found that strength, lean body mass, muscle size, and bone density are only trivially affected by testosterone suppression. Duke Law put together a study in which they analyzed female athletes compared to male athletes for the win. Their findings were can be viewed here, comparing the best results of women to the best results of underage boys, of men, and showing the number of outperformances of men compared to women in all of these track events. And according to the courts, Mr. Chair, there are inherent differences between men and women, and these differences remain cause for celebration, but not for denigration of the members of either sex or for artificial constraints on an individual's opportunity. That's United States versus Virginia. Because of innate physiological differences, boys and girls are not similarly situated as they enter athletic competition, according to Klesic v. Rhode Island Interscholastic League. And finally, it takes little imagination to realize that were play and competition not separated by sex, the great bulk of the females would quickly be eliminated from participation and denied any meaningful opportunity for athletic improvement or involvement. That's from Kate v. Tennessee Secondary School Athletic Association. And with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes the presentation.
All right. Was the slideshow, most of it looked familiar, but could this be on basis under education, or had y'all changed it?
It is, Mr. Chair, but this is a condensed version, so it didn't have all the slides. So there's a very thorough presentation under education for SB 140.
All right. I'm going to ask the committee to, we'd like to hear Craig Taylor. He has a time conflict. I'd like to go to Mr. Taylor first and offer him the Attorney General Taylor, offer him the opportunity to speak on Senate Bill 140, and then we'll probably go to questions for the Attorney General or the sponsor. We'll do with that. So, Mr. Attorney General, if you can hear me, if you'd care to state your name, your affiliation, and your location, put yourself on the record, your invited testimony on Senate Bill 140.
Yeah, so my name is Craig Taylor. I'm currently the Alaska's Attorney General.
And one of the things I like to know for people who join us electronically is your location. And if, after you state that, if you just do you have anything to offer on Senate Bill 140?
Yeah, so my location, I'm currently in my office in Anchorage. You know, I've looked over all of the letters and the correspondence in regard from legislative counsel and from testimony, and when I look at this bill, there's no facial constitutional infirmity with this bill that I can see as it pertains to Alaska law or to federal law that includes Alaska Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. As I looked at the legislative counsel's letters and information on this, I repeatedly saw things as may, might, could, you know, there was no certainty that they could point to. Certainly there are arguments that can be made, and that's the case with any type of statutory provision that comes out that can be challenged. But on its face, there's nothing about SB 140 that is unconstitutional.
All right. Thank you, Attorney General. That went quicker than I thought. So we have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess since we have the Attorney General with us, I noted that the sponsor made mention of a couple of federal court cases from some time ago. And I wondered, have federal courts distinguished those cases with regard to transgender individuals in more recent years?
Well, I'm not sure which cases you're alluding to, Senator Kill, through the chair. But, you know, clearly I think the big case that is pointed to recently is the Bostock case. But Bostock made it court, the Supreme Court made it clear in Bostock that it only related to Title VII employment issues. You know, an employer could not discriminate or terminate a person solely based upon their gender identity or sexual orientation. I think there's been an effort throughout the nation and throughout the country to make that Title VII decision apply to all other areas where gender is an issue, and we haven't seen any dispositive things from federal courts on that issue. And so we'll wait to see how the federal courts weigh in on those types of issues.
I'll follow up, Senator Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, actually, that was my next question, Mr. Chairman, to the Attorney General, was that the Supreme Court's analysis in Bostock, while its application was limited to employment, their analysis of the questions before them were that to conclude that discrimination on the basis of either sexual orientation or of gender identity involves sex as a but-for cause. So how do you see Alaska courts or other courts distinguishing the language that Senator Hughes, that the sponsor read from Title IX, which refers to discrimination on the basis of sex, identical language to the statutory language analyzed by the court in Bostock?
Well, I think interesting, Senator Kill, through the chair, again, for the record, this is Strick Taylor, the Attorney General, is that, you know, under Legislative Council's analysis, Title IX itself would be potentially unconstitutional. And so, you know, as I went through their analysis, they're, you know, when they didn't find a right to privacy, then they went on to equal protection. It's easy to see why you don't see an equal protection issue if you don't understand the underlying legitimate state interest at issue here, which I think was adequately pointed out when the introduction of this bill for this hearing. And so I, you know, whether there are arguments to be made on either side, yeah, that's up for debate, but up for debate, and that's up for ultimately, I think, the courts to decide. But whether there's clearly a constitutional infirmity with this bill, there clearly is not, in my opinion.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Attorney General. Are there any other questions for the Attorney General? And seeing none, I appreciate you joining us today. I understand you may have a conflict to, you know, another obligation to go take care of. Once again, Attorney General Trey Taylor, thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you, Chair Holland, and my pleasure.
And at this point, we'll go to Mario Byrd. Mr. Byrd, if you can hear me, please state your name, any affiliation, your location, and begin with your invited testimony.
Thank you, Chair Holland. My name is Mario Byrd. I am an attorney practicing in Anchorage, and I'm also speaking from Anchorage today. I'm here to testify on the legality of Senate Bill 140 as applied under the Alaska State Constitution. And I just want to address three points. The first one is equal protection. The second one is the right to privacy, Article 1, Section 22, and then Article 1, Section 3, the civil rights provision in the Alaska Constitution. I want to start by reiterating Justice Ginsburg's opinion in U.S. versus Virginia. This is the VMI case where there were young ladies who were suing to get into the Virginia Military Institute. In that case, Justice Ginsburg wrote the opinion of the court and said, physical differences between men and women, however, are enduring. The two sexes are not fungible. That, I think, along with Justice Ginsburg's work while she was at the EEOC as a federal attorney, is the basis for distinguishing between biological males and biological females. And that is also the basis for Senate Bill 140. With regard to equal protection, there is already within that chapter of Alaska statute that distinction made between male and female. I'm looking specifically at Alaska Statute 14.18.050B. Separation of the sexes is permitted during sex education programs and during participation in physical education activities if the purpose of the activity involves bodily contact. So that's already part of Alaska law, and you can see why. It's based on the differences between biological female and biological male bodies. There's an extensive discussion of federal law that I'm going to avoid for now, in part because it's not my expertise, but I understand that in previous committees it's been discussed why and how under the Federal Register, Title 34, 106.41, and then what Attorney General Taylor just alluded to regarding Title IX. Yes, under the analysis that seems to be offered by some of the stuff I've seen from Ledge Legal, Title IX itself would be unconstitutional and would defy equal protection. I don't think that's the state of the law. I think that that analysis is flawed insofar as they're trying to use equal protection to knock down all of Title IX. I do want to point out that Alaska has some exemplars on both sides of this issue. Back in the, I think, the late 2000s, Michaela Hutchinson was the first female to compete and to win a state wrestling championship. There was another gal after that, Hope Stephenson, who did the same thing. I myself, when I was competing in high school sports, I played against Carrie Weiland and Hannah Carlson, both of whom went on to stellar careers in hockey, but they were playing in largely a male area. That's the way things have been in Alaska, especially when it comes to smaller schools. And women have excelled, and they've gone on to careers at the national level. Contrast, on the other side of the case, there's Natafon Wangyat, who is the biological male who competed at the state track competition 6 years ago in May, and he competed as a female. Natafon won third place and fifth place. So I do want to bring that up so that the committee knows. I think there was a statement that the Alaska Association of School Boards said we haven't seen any sort of evidence that female sports have been affected by transgender athletes. I think that's not true, and it's fairly easy to see that this issue came to the fore in part because of an Alaskan athlete, a biological male who is competing in women's sports. So again, in summary, I don't see equal protection under Alaska's case law and under the Equal Protection Clause. I don't see that as striking down SB 140. With regards to the second point, the right to privacy, again, the way I see the current ASA, Alaska State Association of Activity Association rules, they're predicated on a number of things, including a medical exam, whether a student's taken a sufficient course load to be able to compete, whether or not they've fulfilled the transfer requirements, GPA, whether they're attending school, whether they've been recruited, what their age is, and whether they've had other eligibility considerations because they've previously been involved as a junior high student, and then the general citizenship or expulsion cause for being ineligible. Again, all of these are already pre-existing privacy issues, but we don't see people suing on the basis of right to privacy, and that's because schools don't disclose them. Schools don't go out of their way to disclose if you're failing a grade, but you are ineligible. That's the way that I lived too when I was a high school athlete, as did male and female athletes at that time. The last issue, that Article 1, Section 3 of Alaska's Constitution deals with civil rights, and it copies in large part its federal counterpart. No person is to be denied enjoyment of any civil or political right because of race, color, creed, sex, or national origin. I have combed, and I have not found any reference to that in the opposition briefs put forward by Ledge Legal, and I don't know why that is. It seems to me that would be relevant. If I had to guess, it's because there is case law out there that establishes that our state Supreme Court will allow separate accommodations dependent on sex. There's a criminal case out there where the criminal statute had to do with prostitution. The court struck it down because it was simply female. And any distinctions as to gender must rest upon some logical justification having a basis in the actual conditions of human life. That is what this bill puts front and center, that there is scientific data that confirms that there's a difference between a biological male and a biological female when it comes to athletic performance. So even if this case, and this is an old case, 79, even if this case were to be used, and again, I haven't seen it used by anybody, it seems to me that this SB 140 would pass muster. The other thing that's very interesting, and for those of you who practice law on the committee, the District Court of Alaska at one point allowed judges to require certain types of business attire, and still do, but that was there's a differentiation between depending on what sex you were. That went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found that there's no merit in contention that the coat and tie requirement amounts to impermissible gender discrimination because it applies to males, not to females. So the case law that is out there indicates that this is permissible. The last point I want to make, Mr. Chair, is that both the constitutional right to privacy and the constitutional civil rights provision within Alaska's constitution state specifically, black letter law, the legislature shall implement this section. In your role as senators and in the greater role of both chambers, you're doing what the Constitution has instructed you. That is, it is your job, in my opinion, to implement what these things mean by passing legislation and making sure it goes through the process to confirm that this is going to be good law. And I think that's already happened once from the original version of the bill to what is now, I understand, version B. So I just want to, again, confirm, in my opinion, this meets constitutional muster under Alaska case law and the Alaska Constitution, and I think the Senate's doing its job in supporting this bill, and I'd recommend that you pass it out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. And I see a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Start maybe with just a couple factoids. You don't get the privilege of any attorneys on this committee. There's zero of us, and there are no opposition briefs in here. The question, I guess, the first question to Mr. Byrd, you cited to Justice Bader Ginsburg's opinion in the Virginia Military Institute case. I was a little confused. It was a portion of her reasoning in a ruling that struck down Virginia Military Institute's attempt to discriminate on the basis of sex and segregate. Can you maybe help with what your rationale was there?
Yes, through the chair. My understanding, and I'd be happy to go back and read the case again and provide notes to the committee, but my understanding is that while it was striking down the discrimination portion, it was maintaining that separate facilities for those of the female biological sex can and should be maintained to provide for females having separate facilities. That is why I think that language appears there about physical differences between men and women, however, are enduring. So even as Justice Ginsburg was writing for the court saying that the Virginia Military Institute could not exclude completely. At the same time, it should, and to my understanding, does provide for separate barracks, separate locker rooms, et cetera. And again, that's the same thing that we see in not only SB 140, but what already exists in Alaska Statute 1418.050.
Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the next you echoed an argument that the bill's sponsor made, that there is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, significant evidence, however you stated it, that there are such differences between genders on the basis of biological sex that this bill might be justifiable. I guess it would be helpful to get a better understanding of two things. One would be, is it ever acceptable to discriminate within the boundaries of a single sex. And here I think of runners like Semenya or Mboma or Masalingi. And the second would be that definition of biological sex itself, because I think that's tied in.
Through the chair, I'm not aware of the runners that Senator Keel is talking about, but as I understand his question first is it ever acceptable to discriminate within a biological sex? So there's a whole area of law that deals with that, I think, with the Americans with Disabilities Act. If I correctly understand what he's talking about, maybe I don't. I'm thinking of the case of I can't remember the guy's name. I know his first name was Casey, but the one who sued the PGA so that he could compete. Maybe that's not what he's talking about. Maybe he's talking about sexes in a different sense. But as far as discrimination in the sense of is it ever appropriate to set off one competitor from another, for reasons of competition, I think that happens every day when it comes to JV or varsity, or if you're competing at a local or a regional or a state track meet or any other competition that has a male and a female component. Yeah, I think at least last I checked, you did have to make certain requirements if you were going to be eligible to compete at the state meet as a high school athlete. And then the other question Senator Keel asked regarding biology, I think that the bill is pretty clear about what constitutes a biological sex. I think it's an improvement from what the original version of the bill was. I don't see legal problems with it.
Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Jarrett. So the term biological sex is actually undefined in the bill, and I'm looking for help understanding that. Are we talking, as in the case of some of those runners I mentioned, about testosterone levels? Are we talking, as in the case of one of those runners I mentioned, about chromosomes? Or is it there's a separate reference within the bill to the birth certificate? Is that biological sex? Please help me understand this this concept as it applies here and would be upheld by the courts.
Yeah, through the chair, I think that the birth certificate provision is going to be similar to, again, the medical, the physicals that are required of athletes before they can compete currently under the current OSHA rules. So if a school already has records of a birth certificate, I think that is what this bill puts forward as the reference point for biological sex.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's helpful to know that the bill has nothing to do with physical characteristics, whatever. That's useful.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. I don't believe we have any more questions. At this point, I'll look to the sponsor. Are there any more questions for the sponsor on this bill? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did want to get clarification on the liability provisions. The bill creates rights of action, and I wondered if the sponsor could speak to they don't appear to apply to any of our, or rather none of our tort caps appear to apply to the right of action here. What is envisioned in the remedies and the liabilities that the bill creates?
Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F. Through the chair, Senator Keel, we did add an amendment in the second version, making very clear that there's nothing in this bill that's trying to prohibit due process, so a person could still take something to the court. One of our goals is to protect school districts and schools from expensive and repeated cases for following the law. They follow the law. They shouldn't have to get in the middle of that, but that person could still take that to court. So that is, my staff may want to add to that, but that's the gist. And if I'm not answering your question more directly, if you want to explain more, and if I can't answer it now, I will get back with you. And I also would welcome Mr. Byrd's interpretation of the section regarding the liability and the due process.
You want me to check?
Sure. Yeah.
Mr. Bird, are you still tuned in?
He's no longer with us.
Oh, we've lost Mr. Oh. Bird.
So then to further clarify, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that couple of questions embedded in the first one. Let's split them out. The first would be, what sorts of remedies might a court order here? If an athlete, student athlete comes in and asserts that I was not able to get that full ride scholarship to that Ivy League school because of noncompliance with this law, would the court then order that the student be reimbursed for the full cost of attending that Ivy League school, or do we envision other remedies? That's question. I guess that's question one.
I think Senator Hughes might be bold to speak on what the courts may do, but
that I was going to say, I am not one to say how what the court may see as fit as a remedy. Senator Keel, through the chair.
So then, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we set aside the question of remedy, which I think is still pretty significant. We may need to return to it. What then, we talk about both direct and indirect harm. So because this is not subject to Alaska's other tort caps, do we envision pain and suffering damages, not penal damages, what's the word I'm looking for? Punitive, thank you. Punitive damages. What are we suing for when we create this right of action?
You know, that would be on a case-by-case basis through the chair, Senator Keel. I can't predict exactly what a scenario might be and a person might be suing for. I'm not prepared to speak to that. With the chair's permission, we're going to have a couple more attorneys on Monday. If you want to revisit that question with them, they might be better prepared to answer it. Does my staff have anything to add to that?
Through the chair, Daniel Phelps, staff to Senator Hughes. I don't have anything to add other than that this bill has, and especially through the amendments in the last committee, has taken a step back from prescribing what the courts ought to and ought to not do. And we're leaving that to the courts to determine, as is rightfully their role.
Senator Keel.
To tee up, unless the sponsor has a quick answer to hand, to tee up for the attorneys, the bill also prohibits, I think, some folks from suing. And I would like maybe an understanding of how we see the separation of powers there for folks who may not take adverse action. And so that raises, I think, some constitutional concerns for me.
Through the chair, page 3 of the bill, nothing abrogates, restricts, or otherwise limits the access of any person to a state or federal court or a person's right to bring in state or federal court a complaint or cause of action arising out of these statutes. So I'm not sure why you're saying that we're limiting who can bring something forward. Could you please point that out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at page 2, at lines 22, 23, we have limitations on taking adverse action. And I guess the question would be, what you envision there, if not legal action.
Thank you for the opportunity to clarify that. And we did have conversation with the alleged legal drafter. That is not referring to adverse action through the courts. The example of that would be if one school district felt like another school district that's going to be competing isn't doing what they're supposed to be, they couldn't use that to prevent that school from participating in a tournament, for instance. So it's adverse action outside of the courts. And we actually were considering clarifying that, and our drafter said that wasn't necessary. By adding the final section regarding courts, they thought that was clarification enough. So thank you for giving us the opportunity. It's to get that intent on the record, that adverse action on page 2, line 23, it does not pertain to action through the courts.
Thank you.
And that's, I appreciate Senator Hughes. That was, I think, three of the amendments might have had to do exactly with that, trying to clarify the words adverse action that we took in education. Senator Keel, do you have anything, any other questions?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how our time is. Yes, one from the original presentation on the bill, just to come back to that. Can the sponsor's office clarify, please, how many districts have and how widespread is the availability of co-ed teams in the sports that are available to varsity level, or maybe I should say the inter-school level within Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't have that data. We can follow up with that. We understand it actually is quite common, particularly in the smaller schools. I am aware of it in large schools as well. If this bill were to pass, there'd be nothing prohibiting a school district to expanding the co-ed opportunities as well.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think quantifying that would be useful, both the current availability and the cost. Because I guess there was a statement that the bill is neutral as to gender identity, and the explanation was that a co-ed team is available, and the implication, although not explicitly stated, was that they're widely available. And I'm not sure that a bill specifically designed to separate people on gender identity can be neutral as to gender identity, so that the factual analysis will help.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. With that, I believe we're done with questions on Senate Bill 140. And I do plan to take amendments on this bill on Monday morning. We're going to have a different meeting on Monday. It's not going to be at the normal time. It's 9 a.m. And so please be prepared with any amendments you wish to offer. And at this time, I will set Senate Bill 140 aside. I'm sorry.
Nope. May I make a comment because I may be late Monday morning?
Okay.
Just for the record, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to point out a couple things. One, it was talked about the females and the examples of them in sports where they had done well. And that is true. There are some. But by a statistically almost impossible margin, a strong female that does well in a male-dominated sport is the rare exception. It is not the rule. And if you take that to the other side, in a female-dominated sport where it's for females and there's a male, they tend to do rise to the very top because of those biological differences at birth. Men are different biologically than females, with rare exception and chemical enhancements and others. And then the other point I want to make, Mr. Chairman, if I go back to this, I could go back to high school for over a decade. I held records in two different sports. And I went back and looked, oh, look, my name's still on the board. If I had decided that I was a transgender female, to this day, 36 years later, I can guarantee you that my name would still be in every one of those categories, and every female that tried to compete would never have her name on that board because I would have crushed it in that different category. And so it's very difficult for me, Mr. Chair, to look at this and have to think, I've got to look at my granddaughter and say, sorry, all your hard work is just going to be wiped out by that biologically superior male that's in your sport. I can't support that. So I appreciate you letting me say that for the record, Mr. Chairman, because I know there's a lot of ideological discussion around this bill, but for me, it's actually very simple. Boys and girls are different biologically, and I cannot support something that basically wipes out and puts females back into the Stone Ages. I can't go there. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes.
I'll follow up on that.
As a sponsor, I'll give you a...
Thank you. I just want to point out something that's really fascinating for the public listening as well. There are a few famous female athletes that go down in history, and a lot of young girls look to them, and two of them are sisters, Serena and Venus Williams. And a biological male who ranked 203rd, was able to beat both of those sisters. FloJo, Florence Griffith Joyner. She still holds in track and field. She still holds the 100 meter and 200 meter. A man who ranked 5,606 was able to beat her record. So the differences through the chair that Senator Schauer pointed out are very real. Typically, among biological females, when there's a competition, the differences in those in at the Olympic level are with increments of a second. Same thing for biological males. Our very own Lydia Jacoby, who won the gold medal in the 100 meter in breaststroke, her counterpart was Adam Peaty, who won the same thing in the men's competition. The difference was 7.5 seconds, not increments of a second. So we are asking girls, if we don't set a policy like this, we are setting the girls up for just an impossible situation for them to be able to have an even playing field and to have a chance at victory, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Senator Hughes raises another question here, because the examples, as I understand them, were not competitions with transgender athletes who had been through the various hormonal and other therapies that are part of many people's transitions, and that at the elite levels of athletics are required for trans women to compete as women. Certainly, I know that my constituent, who was misgendered by one of the testifiers, had been through some of those therapies, was allowed under Alaska School Activities Association rules to compete, and did not crush it and dominate. And I don't believe in biological superiority of anybody, so I'll leave that alone. And so I guess the question would be, the International Olympic Committee, since Olympians were mentioned, has rules for addressing and protocols for addressing transgender athletes. And I wonder if the sponsor could speak to why she believes that those sorts of rules and protocols are insufficient for Alaska when they'll work for the Olympics.
Well, we've delved back into question and answer on Senate Bill 140. And I'll allow Senator Hughes, if you have something to offer on this one point, and then we'll probably wrap it up, because we do have other people we can give public testimony on another bill.
I'd be happy to answer that, Senator Keel, through the chair. The data shows that even after multiple years of testosterone suppression therapy, there are still significant differences. This one study, 9% difference after multiple years. I've seen studies where it's been as much as 15%. The size of the heart does not change. The size of the lungs do not change. When after testosterone therapy, suppression therapy, the size of the skeleton, the amount of leverage because of the limbs, there is some decrease in the muscle mass, but it's still greater than the females even after multiple years. So there still is a difference.
All right. Thank you, Senator Hughes. With that, I will set Senate Bill 140 aside at this time, and a brief at ease while Senator Hughes gets things sorted away, gets President Ortega table put back together, and comes takes a seat back over the desk. All right, thank you. Senate Bill 196 is before the committee at this time. Senate Judiciary Committee is back in the record. Senate Bill 196 is back before the committee. It's related to compelled speech and instructional material transparency in public education. This is the second hearing on Senate Bill 196. And today we're going to do public testimony on 196. I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 196. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who cares to offer public testimony in Senate Bill 196? I'm going to take a stab at pronouncing your name. Linda Jiguer? Wow, there we go. If you Born in Cajun, Louisiana. Take a seat. Draw the microphone quite close to you if you don't mind. Please state your name and any affiliation, and we'll do about 3 minutes of public testimony.
It will be very short, probably brutal too.
Well, please begin. Once again, state your name, put yourself on the record.
Yes, I will. Thank you. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Linda Jaguar. I've lived my entire adult life in Alaska. I worked many years in this very building for legislators and governors, going back to Governor Jay Hammond. I've witnessed a lot of good as well as some questionable work done here, but overall, I truly believe that the primary goal was to make the lives of Alaskans better and solve real problems. This bill does neither. It is deeply disturbing to me to see bills of this nature spawned and proliferating in the culture war swamps of the lower 48, slither their way into our state capital, and gain traction. SB 196 isn't a solution to any existing problem that I'm aware of. To the contrary, it could make the job of a teacher untenable, drag our children into the hurtful and often hateful rhetoric that routinely passes for public discourse today, as we have seen in school board meetings throughout the country. SB 196 is a cynical distraction from real issues facing us today. In addition to being anti-education, SB 196 ultimately seeks to divide an already fractured population, pull Alaska into the bogus culture wars, now tearing this country apart. Its ultimate goal is to instill fear and distrust, particularly of our teachers, all to just rally the base. A bill like this should find no home here. I urge you not to waste any more time and money on this bill or others like it, and I thank you very much for allowing me to speak today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jaguar.
Thank you very much for saying my name properly.
You're welcome. And at this time, I'll ask you if there's anyone else in the room who wishes to offer public testimony. Seeing no one, we'll look to the phones, and I believe I see two on the phone. Three? All right. So, I think one of them is going to be an invited speaker on this. So we'll go to Philip Moser first, then I believe I'll go to David Boyle after that. So up next will be Philip Moser. If you can hear me, please state your name, any affiliation, your location, and if you would, we'll try to keep it to about 3 minutes of public testimony today.
Thank you. My name is Philip Moser. I'm representing myself, and I live in Juneau. I'm calling in opposition to SB 196. I don't know if there's a moral argument that hasn't already been made for the obscene nature of this bill, but in a legal sense, this bill is also incredibly problematic. A lot of the language and a lot of the mechanisms by which this bill seeks to come down on people for speech in the classroom and for teaching is similar, if not very much the same, as the so-called Don't Say Gay bill introduced and I think in effect in Florida. This bill deputizes regular citizens to punish teachers, and it creates a clear pathway for that. What this means is that teachers who are already underpaid in the state will be subject to litigation from anyone at any point for something as small as, say, if a teacher is gay and they make reference to their husband and that catches wind outside of school, then a parent could easily bring that as a civil suit, according to the language of the bill. That doesn't mean that it would necessarily pass, but it would put the teacher on the hook for that cost and for the trouble of that. Instills a chilling effect for teachers and for schools in general. This bill also ties up the Attorney General, I believe, in what would be quite a few lawsuits. But overall, the issue with teachers and schools being subject to litigation based off of this is clearly intended to erase any mention of race, any mention of sex, any mention of orientation from schools, and people that might abide by those descriptions are also incredibly at risk by this bill. It's meant to erase them from our schools, and that's horrendous. I testified a couple of days ago on a bill also introduced by Reinbold regarding the requirement that every political office, any person applying for those, needs to read the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And you can, for sure, it would be legally actionable to sue a teacher if they mentioned either of those bills, as both inherently and explicitly list out issues based on sex and race. And if those are brought up, you can bet for sure that any teacher or any school that talks about that would be subject to legal action. In summary, please do not support this. This is morally and ethically horrendous, but if you want a legal reason why it's horrendous, there you go. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Moser. Senator Schauer extended his apologies. He has to he has another obligation to attend at this time. Next up will be David Boyle. And Mr. Boyle, if you would state your name and any affiliation and your location and begin your about 3 minutes of public testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Holland, committee members. I'm David Boyle, testifying for myself and many parents and grandparents. I strongly support SB 196 to save our students from being taught to hate each other based on race and ethnic group. We need them to be able to read. I've watched all the meetings on this bill in Senate Ed and Senate Judiciary. I've noticed that those who may oppose this bill point to the possibility that students won't learn about certain events in America's past. That is not and will not happen after this bill becomes law. Alaska students can still learn the following about how our great nation has evolved over time. These are some of our so-called warts. General George Washington ordered recruiting officers to accept free blacks in the American Army. By the way, more than 5,000 blacks fought against the British. The U.S. Constitution stated that blacks were to be counted as only 3/5 of a person. This was not the South's idea. This was demanded by northern states because they feared the South would control the House of Representatives due to their population. Abraham Lincoln, Republican president, only freed the slaves in the South with the Emancipation Proclamation. He did not free the slaves in the North. There were early presidents that also owned slaves, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, William Henry Harrison, James K. Polk, Martin Van Buren, James Tyler, Zachary Taylor, Andrew Johnson, and U.S. Grant. But there were black slave owners as well. Five former slaves, believe it or not, were elected to the U.S. House and Senate before 1875, a mere 10 years after the Civil War ended. The KKK was formed to push back against Republican Reconstruction efforts in the South. Democrats in the South passed Jim Crow laws to keep blacks out of the voting booth. Japanese Americans were interred in camps during World War II by President Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat. President Truman, a Democrat, integrated the U.S. Armed Forces in the late 1940s. Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat of West Virginia, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan while a U.S. Senator. President Eisenhower, Republican, sent the National Guard to Little Rock, Arkansas High School to enforce integration against Governor Paulus, a Democrat. President Kennedy, a Democrat, sent the Justice Department and U.S. Marshals to the University of Alabama to enforce integration. Governor George Wallace of Alabama was a Democrat. Senator Strom Thurmond, Democrat, South Carolina, filibustered against the Civil Rights Act in 1957 for 24 straight hours. And in 1964, Southern Democrats filibustered the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for 60 days, the longest filibuster ever. By the way, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a manufactured incident to get the U.S. involved heavily in the Vietnam War. President Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, then changed the lives of many of us forever. We lost more than 58,000 brave Americans. President George W. Bush, Republican, used the weapons of mass destruction to get the U.S. to invade Iraq, which we found was not true. And Vice President Joe Biden was the only person in the war room to oppose taking out Osama bin Laden. So yes, we as a country have our warts, and these are just a few, but we're getting better every day. We're not a perfect nation, but if you have traveled around this world, you will note America is the best place to live and raise kids, no matter what. And I'd like to read the resolution from the National Education Association last year, resolution number 39, provide an in-depth study that critiques empire, white supremacy, anti-blackness, racism, patriarchy, capitalism, ableism, and other forms of power and oppression at the intersections of our society, and that we oppose attempts to ban critical race theory and the 1619 Project. So yes, please pass this bill out of committee so parents can be able to know what their children are being taught and to prohibit race-based training of our young children. Otherwise, I'm going to tell you right now, Alaska's K-12 system stands to lose thousands of students. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this important issue.
All right. Thank you, Mr. David Boyle. At this point, I'll just mention the sponsor did apologize that she was unable to attend today. We do have two amendments submitted, but at this time, I will go to Solicitor General Jesse Alloway, who's joining us by phone. And Solicitor General, if you could speak to us about what the bill asks of the Attorney General's office and the accompanying fiscal note.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jesse Alloway. I'm the Solicitor General of Civil Appeals at the Department of Law, and I am testifying from my office in Anchorage. The enforcement provision of the bill does two things. One, it gives the Attorney General express authority to commence a civil action to enforce the law. And then two, it grants the Attorney General the authority to issue advisory opinions that can be requested from the school district, charter school, or public school. The first provision, the authority to bring a civil action, is not necessarily an expansion of the AG's authority. The Alaska Supreme Court has held that the Attorney General has the powers which existed at common law, except where limited by statute or conferred on some other state agency. And under the common law, the Attorney General has the power to bring any action which he thinks is necessary to protect the public interest. And that includes the power to act to enforce an Alaska statute. So he already has that authority, but I'll tell you that the Attorney General exercises that authority very rarely. It's a discretion that's rarely used by the Attorney General, in part because of resources, but in part when he does exercise that authority, it's a significant public interest that he's considering. So I think in the last hearing, Senator Myers asked whether this was something we already had and whether the Attorney General used it regularly, and the answer is yes, we have this authority in the Attorney General's office, but it's not used regularly. This statute just makes express something that I think already exists. The second provision, or the second provision that I'll talk about, is the provision for the advisory opinions. This would be an expansion of the Attorney General's authority and would likely be require a significant amount of resources from the Department of Law. In the appellate section, we do advisory opinions. Those opinions can be through the governor. We do advisory opinions for other state agencies, departments, and the legislature. But those rarely come in. It's infrequent, but it does take a significant amount of work to do those. The other provisions that require us to do advisory opinions would be the ballot initiatives, as well as the Ethics Act allows us to do advisory opinions both for state employees as well as former state employees who may have a question about whether they can do certain work once they leave state employment and enter private practice or private employment. Those require us to act within 60 days after we have a complete request. So there is a back and forth that takes place. So this provision would significantly increase the areas in which we would do advisory opinions.
All right. Thank you, Solicitor General. At this point, we have an amendment that is to address that problem. I'll call Mr. King to the presenter's table. I move amendment number one. If you check, we have two amendments. It's a little confusing. Amendment number one is labeled D.2. Amendment number two is labeled D.1. So we're going to go to amendment number one, labeled D.2. Mr. King, I move amendment number one, labeled D.2. Is there objection? Thank you, Senator Hughes. Mr. King, would you please put yourself on the record and explain amendment number one, labeled D.2?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, staff Senator Holland. Mr. Chairman, amendment number one, I'll just speak generally on what the amendment tries to accomplish, and then we can talk about the mechanics on how that's accomplished, if you like. In effect, what the amendment is doing is it's maintaining that the implementation and enforcement and remedy sections in existing law that cover the rest of Chapter 18 will extend to these new provisions that are being added by this bill. Under the underlying proposed bill, the existing language in Chapter 18 is treated differently, where the enforcement is by the State Board of Education for K-12 and by the Board of Regents for the university. The bill proposes that all of the new law has a different enforcement mechanism through the Attorney General's office. What the amendment does is gets rid of that different new authority or provision to go through the Attorney General's office and maintains that through K-12 education, all of these actions, enforcement actions and remedies, go through the State Board of Education. So what you're seeing is that the language, in effect, sections 2, 3, and 4 are deleted, and then there are components of those sections that are reinstituted that are range binding the implementation of those two provisions, so that the university, because the new provisions of law do not affect the university, don't apply to the university, those provisions that call out the Board of Regents are also range bound to not include the university.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. Are there any questions? Senator Hughes?
Okay, so we're taking it to the normal process of grievance and a complaint through the state school board. Is there anything that would prohibit a person from the independent action of going through the courts?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hughes, through the chair, no. The enforcement by the Board of Education would exist throughout the chapter, including the existing language. And then the remedy provision in 1418.100 would apply through the chapter as well. And I can read that for the record. A person aggrieved by a violation of this chapter, which would include the new language, or of a regulation or procedure adopted under this chapter as a primary or secondary education, may file a complaint with the board and has an independent right of action in superior court for civil damages and for such equitable relief as the court may determine.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Bookkeeping. I did close public testimony, correct? I believe I did. Nancy, if you could confirm that. We'll make sure we did it before we wrap up today. Sarah Keel. Just a bookkeeping question. Can you confirm I closed public testimony? Pretty sure I did. Just in case I did not at this time, I'm going to make sure public testimony is closed. Public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 196. Senator Keel.
Just a detailed question on the amendment, Mr. Chairman. A private person has a private right of action. Do they need to use the State Board of Education first and exhaust that remedy before they go to court, or is it either or?
That may be a question for the Solicitor General.
If they can be of help, that would be appreciated, Mr. Chairman.
Solicitor General Jesse Alloway, are you still tuned in? Looks like there's a shot there.
Mr. Chairman, and again, for the record, the whatever the provisions are under existing law, whether that avenue needs to be exhausted before the court action is available to a plaintiff is consistent with existing law. Nothing in the amendment or the underlying bill would change that if this amendment were to be adopted.
And I'll try, because I had one more question for Solicitor General Alloway. Solicitor General Alloway, if you can hear me, are you still tuned in?
I am, Mr. Chairman, sorry.
That's right. Did you hear the last question?
I did.
Could you just add any insight on that?
I think, so Senators Keel through the chair. I think in this particular situation where the statute is granting a private right of action for an individual, they wouldn't necessarily have to exhaust their administrative remedies. But I would actually want to do more research on that before I give you a definitive answer.
All right. Thank you. Are there any other questions? I'll just ask Solicitor General Alloway, can you comment? So there was a fiscal note from the Department of Law. Can you comment on whether this amendment would make that fiscal note moot or not if this amendment is adopted?
Mr. Chairman, I can. If the amendment is adopted, the fiscal note would be muted because it would take away the extra resources that would be required for the advisory opinions.
All right. Thank you, Solicitor General Alloway. At this point, Senator Keel.
I guess just a question for the offer of the amendment, the chair. I appreciate that your amendment, I understand, thanks to your staff and the Solicitor General, your amendment doesn't make a change. Would it be more, efficient if for purposes of these complaints, we did require them to go to the State Board of Education first, rather than have, I just think about the lawyer costs for the school districts, right? The massive contract costs. Might we create a more efficient system if we required these complaints to go to the state board before filing the suit?
I may let Solicitor General Alloway answer that because I'm not quite sure we could restrict someone's access to the courts. Solicitor General?
Yes, Senator Keel, through the chair, there are provisions within statutes that require a party to exhaust their administrative remedies. And the reason for that is to allow, the school board to fix its own errors before you go into litigation. So I think if there was a provision within the statute that required a party to exhaust their administrative remedies, there wouldn't be any legal problem with that. It would just be they would have to go through that process, and then once that process is complete, if the school board doesn't fix the problem, then you would have the right to appeal or right to pursue an original action in the superior court.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll offer that as a suggestion at the maker of the amendment's option.
I will not pursue that at this time, but I appreciate the offer. This will not be the last committee that this bill is going to look at. We'll have opportunities on the floor if you care to offer that amendment. At this point, having exhausted questions on this amendment, I will ask Senator Hughes, do you maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection.
Is there further objection? Seeing no further objection, amendment number one, labeled D.2, is adopted. And I have one other amendment. Both of these amendments were briefed with the sponsor. She was in favor of both amendments on this. I move amendment number two, labeled D.1.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Mr. King, would you please explain amendment number two, labeled D.1?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For record again, Ed King. Mr. Chairman, the amendment number two is kind of a cleanup amendment that is the result of the amendment process in the previous committee referral. And one of the amendments that occurred created some duplicate language that's in the current version of the bill. So if the members turn to page 4 and look at lines 25 through 27 and compare those to lines 28 through 30, you'll see that those are significantly similar. The difference being that subparagraph B restricts the actions that a person cannot compel a student to do to those concepts described in paragraph 2, whereas in subparagraph A, that is an unbound restriction. The amendment would remove subsection A and retain subparagraph B.
And renumber all of those below it accordingly.
That is correct.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. Is there any further question? We just saw this as a cleanup on the bill. With no further questions, Senator Hughes, do you maintain your objection?
Well, actually, I do have a question because one had the word encourage and the other doesn't have the word encourage. And I know we had a little bit of discussion on that. Are we allowing encouraging? because we're saying may not direct or otherwise. And before we were saying may not encourage direct or otherwise. And I get the duplicity, but just that concept encourage. Did we feel like that wasn't? It was too gray of an area, or I'm just curious.
Senator Hughes, what I'll state is we're not disallowing encourage any more than we were before, because that is to disallow encouraging, directing, or otherwise universally any specific belief or concept, which I think is a wrong thing. So if you care to offer a conceptual amendment to add encourage before the word direct under subsection B, Senator Myers?
Thank you.
Which I'll just state for the record, I'm not really in favor of them. Just make that as an offer. But Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think some of the discussion Senator Hughes was referring to started with me last time around. What I'm looking at, the word encourage to me was a little bit of an issue, because on the section involved here in the amendment, we were talking about what you couldn't do, but then in the section on the next page, about line 15, we said that you could not prohibit voluntary voluntary participation in a seminar, something like this, a professional development, whatever you want to call it. So to me, when we're talking about direct or compel, which also occurs in subparagraph B there, that is problematic, but if you're encouraging somebody, that seems to me that they're already somewhat on the way themselves, and so indicates to me that that's somewhat voluntary, and that's where some of my confusion was coming in, that it looked like we were prohibiting a voluntary action in one and then allowing a voluntary action in the other. So removing the word encourage to me is helpful in the language of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Myers. I would have to agree. I think direct or the words direct or otherwise compel are more active, whereas encourage is a less forceful verb. Mr. King, do you have anything to offer on this?
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that the reference statute that in paragraph 2 is direct or compel, direct or otherwise compel, and does not include encourage. And so for consistency, that is likely why that language does not exist in that subparagraph.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Mr. Chairman, so in 3B, adhere to a belief or concept described in 2 of this subsection. If you go to subsection 2, direct or otherwise compel a student, the word encourage is not in the reference, and therefore it would be more consistent for it to not exist in the referencing statute.
A brief at ease. Sorry, back on the record. I have a difficulty with some soft-spoken people. So I'm going to ask you, if you can, at best, to say that one more time, kind of loud.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I was just saying that the language that exists in the bill currently is consistent between the issue that we're talking, that you all are talking about, and the statute that it's referencing. So a change to that statute would potentially require a change to the other statute as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and I'm going to drop it for now. I mean, I start thinking of every possible scenario, and I think that it's pretty clear direct, compel, encourage does kind of get into a bit of a gray area. But down the road, once they can't direct or compel, if we found that we had a problem with students sensing that a teacher is encouraging them but not specifically directing or compelling, if we found that it was a problem, as students can be influenced by a teacher wanting to be in their good graces, keep their grades up, get extra credit or whatever, even if it's not specifically named, you're going to get, you know, a better score if you go with what I'm encouraging you. I am concerned about it, but I think keeping a clear line at this point, and then we can observe what happens in the future once they can't direct or compel. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Senator Hughes. Is there any further discussion on this? Senator Hughes, do you maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further objection? Seeing none. Amendment number 2, labeled D.1, is adopted. Thank you, Mr. King.
And Mr. Chairman, the sponsor is available.
All right. With that, I'll ask, are there any other amendments from the committee? And seeing none. So I do see that Senator Reinbold, you've been able to join us by phone. Thank you so much. If you care to offer a wrap-up, Senator Reinbold, please state your name and your location and put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill and honorable members of the Judiciary Committee. I would like to say to Senator Laura Reinbold, District G, and I would like to say I did work with the sponsor and his staff, Ed King, on the amendments, and I do support them both, as you got on record. And with that, I think it's critical to have dignity and transparency in education, and I appreciate the consideration and even the improvements to the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Reinbold. With no further discussion, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We ran low on time the last time the bill was up. I guess that we had this conversation about verbs and what exactly they do in the bill, and I guess I just need a little bit more clarification from the sponsor. Does this bill stop a school district from teaching these concepts as long as they don't give a test on it or make a student say, yes, I believe it?
Senator Reinbold, are you still available?
I'm available. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to follow protocol. The bill is very careful in how it is worded. So if they are inherently teaching that because of the color of your skin, you are inherently one way or another, that would not be allowed. So it's very clear. There's a very tiny bookend in regards to we just don't want to be spending taxpayer money to teach people to hate each other based on the color of their skin, or that the country is inherently sexist, biased in regards to, or inherently racist. And so it's very clear in that section too exactly what they, very small bookends of what we don't want to spend state public education dollars or basically public dollars to be spent teaching our children to either hate each other or the country. And that's why DeSantis did this, and there's many other states that have legislation in. I think it's 13. I'd have to clarify that with the state right now. I mean, excuse me, with my staff, but the bottom line is this is very, very – I've gone over this over and over again, Jesse, exactly – or Senator Gill, excuse me, of what it does, and it's very, very well clarified in this section. And so with that, if you could just refer back to that, it's clear of what you're allowed to do and what is prohibited. And Senator Hughes did some really good clarifying amendments in education as well. So she could answer as well if she cares to. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, and maybe Senator Reinbold could because I think there might have been a little bit of confusion. So nothing in this bill would prohibit a teacher discussing racism, for as an example, and or discussing discrimination. So it can be taught. It's just that the teacher can't direct or compel the student to take a certain position on those. And one of the things that Senator Keel, through the chair, you might be interested to know in looking to make sure we weren't prohibiting instruction about Martin Luther King or the Holocaust or something like that, we did talk to Ledge Legal if we needed clarifying language to make sure that these concepts could be taught. And it wasn't found to be necessary. It's just they could be taught. Just at the end of that instruction, the teacher could not force the students to affirm, adhere, what's the third verb, compel, whatever. So it could be taught. They just can't require the student to take a position.
Mr. King, join us at the center's table. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Ed King for the record. And I would just point the committee to page 5, starting on line 12. That's subsection B. And this outlines the kinds of conduct that are not prohibited, and that includes speech that's protected by the Constitution or the state of Alaska. Constitution. It also includes voluntary, uninduced, or uncoerced attendance or participation, and it also includes educational in-school discussion of or assignment of material that does incorporate those beliefs, so long as the school clarifies that the school does not sponsor, approve, or endorse that concept or material.
All right. Thank you, Mr. King. Thank you, Senator Q. Is there any further, having no further amendments and seeing no further discussion on this bill, I will look to Senator Hughes for the will of the committee.
No further questions. I guess, are you ready for a little, if you're looking for the will of the committee, you want me to speak now or after the motion?
You can speak now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate from Senator Hughes and from the committee staff. That while that's a little bit helpful, ultimately, the bill has, I think, irredeemable problems. It creates this bizarre situation where a school can teach American history and with warts and all, but couldn't give a test on it because you have to affirm that a thing is true. And the bill is very explicit. You can't require a student to do that. So as it goes through and tries to cancel certain concepts, what it's going to do by its very language is take parts of American history out of the schools. And that's a problem. These are concepts, depending on how you read one of them, that almost universally I find pretty loathsome. I disagree with. But when I went to high school in Alaska, we engaged in discussion about and we took courses on all kinds of ideas and all kinds of facts in history, all kinds of bad behavior in history. And it was an important part of the educational process. And this bill wrenches any effective teaching of that out of our schools in an attempt to cancel these ideas. It also has some really bizarre gaps. I don't understand why in attempting to cancel some ideas, it doesn't cancel the teaching of ableism, of the notion that some people with disabilities are inherently inferior, or for that matter, that people without disabilities are inherently superior. It's not covered. It is a loathsome philosophy that we've seen before. We discussed in the last hearing that this doesn't cover any oppression, inferiority, or superiority based on class, whether that's caste systems or the communist theories of class. I'm not sure if we're going to cancel things that we consider un-American, why we're doing some and not others in this bill. And then finally, I guess there are all these undefined terms within the bill. And I would just note that the committee finished hearing assertions that some folks have inherent biological superiorities, that the phrase was used here in the discussion in certain contexts. And this bill would cancel that discussion in our schools. Fascinating. I'm not sure how that works, but it sure doesn't. Not to put too fine a point on it, this bill doesn't look too good for the one before it. So inherently, this cancel culture bill is a problem for our schools. We also should probably just talk for a minute. We have this weird tradition where we don't look at the cost to school districts of our legislation because they don't issue fiscal notes. They're not state agencies. But they are state entities, right? They're political subdivisions. And as a former legislative finance director used to point out, their bills are the state's bills when it comes right down to it. To monitor the curricula of every teacher, every lesson plan of every teacher. I talked with some folks at the State School Boards Association. They couldn't come up with numbers.
Senator Keel, I'm going to have to ask you. It's like I don't believe this bill asks us to monitor. You speak to that by affirming, using the word affirm, it invalidates the ability of a teacher to test on a subject. I don't believe that's the definition of the word affirm. some of, you use the word fascinating. I find fascinating some of the leaps that you make sometimes. And I'm not sure how you come to some of the conclusions you come to. At some point, I just have to ask, how does this bill require us to monitor every classroom and every what it does require is a teacher to post a, I believe, to publicly, transparently post the curricula, but we don't monitor every classroom. Oh, how does it monitor every classroom?
Thank you. I apologize that I was unclear. I was speaking to the cost to school districts. Because a school district faces the potential for an expensive lawsuit if it does not post the curriculum right down to each lesson plan, each school district is going to have to monitor what each teacher teaches or else face the risk of those private lawsuits.
I'm not quite sure I see that because I don't know how it will come forth unless I'm not quite sure how that is, how that will come to litigation. And at some point when we have more time, I think I'll be happy to have this conversation with you. But we are already past 3:05, and if you could wrap your comments up, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Section 6 of the bill requires the transparency parts from school district, and those are subject to lawsuit if you fail to live up to them. So at any rate, I'll just wrap up with that discussion with the Association of School Boards. They estimated that our mid-sized school districts probably need a full-time position each, our very large districts more than that. And ultimately, that's a cost that doesn't go to educating kids. That's just overhead. So along with the unconstitutional parts, along with the weird decisions about what to cancel and what not to, and scrubbing a lot of American history out of our classrooms, I'm going to oppose the bill.
I appreciate that. I think we have to agree to disagree on many of the definitions you use for verbs that you use. But with that being said, is there any other further comment from the committee?
Yes, and I'm ready to make the motion, too, following that, unless somebody else has a comment. This is not going to scrub American history. It doesn't cancel discussion. It does not cancel discussion about concepts and beliefs. It disallows the teacher forcing the student to take a certain position on those concepts or beliefs. So I want to get that very clear. If there are gaps in this bill, it's our responsibility to bring forward amendments. I'm sure if we wanted to add class as one of the items, that probably might have been adopted by this committee. So I just want to say this is a real thing happening in our schools, and if we do not see that, we're blindfolded to it because it is out there. And I appreciate Mr. Boyle's reading the resolution that NEA adopted, I believe, that was entertained last July 2021. This is a real concern of parents, and I think that we have to look out for our kids and make sure that they are allowed to develop their own open minds and critically think on these various important concepts in the United States of America, including throughout our history. So with that, I'm ready to make the motion when you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further discussion, I look to to Senator Hughes for the will of the committee.
Yeah, thank you. I move that the committee substitute for SB 196, Work Order 32-LS0768/G, as amended, be reported from the committee with individual recommendations and one attached zero fiscal note.
Okay. Senator Keel, would you like to speak to your objection?
Did that, thanks.
All right, Madam Secretary, would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Yes. No.
Yes. With a vote of 3 yeas and 1 nay, Senate Bill 196 has been reported for the committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note. We will sign the paperwork after adjourning. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Monday, May 2nd at 9 a.m., and we are adjourned at 3:08 p.m.